From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. More than 7,000 languages are spoken around the globe, and researchers have picked up on a curious fact. As you move from the Earth's poles toward the equator, you hear more languages. Why do humans speak so many languages? And why so many more in the tropics? Do languages diversify the way plant species do? Dr. Michael Gavin, an ecologist in Colorado State University's Department of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources, is looking for answers on islands in the South Pacific.
If the rest of the world had the language density that Vanuatu had in terms of number of speakers per language, there'd be 3.2 million languages on the planet.
Languages as a window into human history. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. According to the language research site Ethnologue, more than 7,000 languages are spoken around the globe. About one-third have fewer than 1,000 speakers. The most common languages are Chinese, with more than a billion speakers, followed by Spanish, English, Arabic, and Hindi. But language researchers have picked up on a curious fact. As you move from the Earth's poles toward the equator, more and more languages are spoken. In fact, the greatest number of languages are spoken in tropical regions. Papua New Guinea, located right below the equator, has the most living languages, 840. And southeast of Papua New Guinea is Vanuatu, a country with 110 languages and the highest density of languages, one language for every 42 square miles. Joining me to discuss this phenomenon is Michael Gavin, Associate Director of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much.
You recently wrote a piece for the website The Conversation in which you asked, why is it that humans speak so many languages, and why are they so unevenly spread across the planet? And then you went on to write, as it turns out, we have few clear answers to these fundamental questions, but I'm going to press you for some answers. You've been to Vanuatu. Tell us about the language density there.
Yeah, that's where I really started my interest in these questions. It's really phenomenal. I mean, there's a little over 200,000 people speaking about 110 different languages, and I began my work there on the island of Malekula, which it turns out probably has roughly 40 different languages, despite being relatively small. It's like 100 kilometers by about 20 kilometers. So incredible number of languages in a relatively small area and with not that many people.
What are the languages most widely spoken?
Well, I mean, Vanuatu has a lingua franca, which developed much later as like a trade language. So it's a Creole language called Bislama. Beyond that, most of the languages have, you know, very few speakers, as you mentioned in your introduction. And so each island has a series of different languages, and there's no one language that predominates across the entire country other than that one lingua franca.
And these native languages, are they completely distinct languages, or are they more like dialects?
No, these are just completely distinct languages. You know, so linguists define languages as being, you know, mutually unintelligible from one another, and that's what these languages are. So what's truly phenomenal is that you have, you know, one village that can see another village, you know, from one spot to another, and yet they speak distinct languages. Now, many of these languages are related to each other, but still, you know, they are distinct.
I want to play some words from the different languages spoken on Malekula. Take a listen to the word for red.
Moneme.
Miveng.
Imial.
Perper.
Mel.
Osongsong.
Imamal.
And here's yellow.
Timeler.
Mwelmolang.
Iwot.
Eingango.
Waswasi.
Lit.
Hi lut lut. Miatsatsen.
So how much more language diversity is found in tropical areas than in the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astounding the differences in terms of the density of languages. So, you know, like you mentioned, you have places like New Guinea, Vanuatu, the Solomon Islands, where you have, you know, a huge number of languages in a relatively small area with not a huge number of speakers. And then you go up to a place like Russia, where you're covering a huge area, and Russia has, you know, a little over 100 languages spoken in that very large area. So, you know, the differences are pretty huge in terms of how many languages are spoken per area.
And is the Russian territory big enough to illustrate what we were talking about a minute ago? Is there more diversity of language in southern Russia than up in Siberia?
I'm actually not that familiar with the, you know, how language diversity varies within Russia itself, but we certainly see it in other, you know, other places on other continents. So, you know, we did a study recently in Australia where you see a huge variation from one place to another. We see it in North America as well. So my guess would be yes, but I haven't actually looked in detail at a map of Russia recently.
But the reason for varying numbers of languages is not population size?
Well, I mean, that could be part of the puzzle, perhaps, in terms of, you know, how many speakers are in a particular spot. So, but we still see big variation depending on the number of speakers. So Vanuatu, which has 110 languages, has far, far fewer speakers in it than a similar tropical country like Bangladesh, which has far, far fewer languages in it. So just the number of speakers isn't necessarily going to describe it. You know, for example, you know, we did a calculation recently. If the rest of the world had the language density that Vanuatu had in terms of number of speakers per language, there'd be 3.2 million languages on the planet.
Oh, my.
It varies quite a bit.
Does it have something to do, the language diversity, something to do with when these areas were inhabited, earlier than other places or later?
Yeah, certainly a possibility is the amount of time that goes by. However, at the same time, I mean, if we look at places that have been inhabited for a very long time, you know, like parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and then we look at places that have been inhabited for far less time, like Vanuatu, where people may have been for 3,000 to 4,000 years, time alone isn't describing the pattern. Certainly, over time, you're going to have more languages developing, but that in and of itself isn't going to explain the broad global pattern that we see.
That's Michael Gavin, Associate Professor of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. Here on The Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about why humans speak so many different languages. I want to take a step back. What does it mean to study the human dimensions of natural resources?
Yeah, so I study basically how people relate to their environment. And so the human dimensions aspects are using different aspects of social science to begin to understand the relationship between people and the environment more broadly. And so I actually started my work and still do work a great deal on traditional ecological knowledge, so how different groups, mostly of indigenous people, relate and manage resources. And that's actually what got me to Vanuatu, which then led to my interest in language diversity patterns.
So you got to Vanuatu before you had focused on language diversity as your topic area, your research focus?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd gone there because I knew there was a lot of different indigenous groups there. I'm not a linguist. I had no idea about the languages there. And I began working there trying to understand how people were managing their environment and how that differed from one community to another. And we were doing the research in a participatory way. So we had people working with us from lots of different communities. And it was when we brought those people together and I realized that each of these communities on the small island spoke a totally different language that I asked this question, you know, why are there so many languages on this island? And to be honest, I thought the answer would be on Wikipedia. But we still, I went back and discovered that's not the case. And not only is that not the case, but we really actually don't know the answer to that question, not only for this one island, but even globally.
So how do you measure what you measure? I mean, for example, how do you measure what's been lost in language?
These things are difficult to pull together over time, and so we have lots of different databases that have come together. You mentioned in your introduction the Ethnologue, and there are several different databases like that where you know, they've compiled information from linguists, from fieldwork that linguists have done around the world, both looking at how many speakers there are, how much the language is being passed on from generation to generation to get a feel for levels of language loss, but also comparing, you know, one language in one group to another to try to determine diversity patterns. So really, this is a compilation of lots of work being done by lots of different linguists and others over a long period of time.
You developed a model to predict language diversity. That model is based around three different assumptions. What are they?
Yeah, so we were looking specifically at Australia, and we wanted to understand the language patterns within Australia. And so really what we wanted to do was demonstrate, hey, can this approach, can this modeling approach work to really understand what the mechanisms are that are causing different languages to form, or boundaries between different groups of people? So what's driving the process that develops language diversity? And so we really wanted to build the simplest model we could just to see if this methodology would work. And so we actually assumed that this model would fail, that it wouldn't do a good job of predicting it, but that it would demonstrate how a particular method might be used to begin to understand what are the processes underneath these patterns that are creating these patterns of language diversity. And so the three different factors that we started with were, one, that people would move to fill empty space. So if you imagine dropping a group of people onto a map, you know, in a simulated sort of situation in a computer, that they would then spread and fill the map with people. And then the next one was that the number of people that could live in a particular area was being shaped by certain environmental factors. And so when we thought about it for Australia, if you knew something about the environment of Australia, it doesn't take long to settle upon precipitation or rainfall. You know, it varies enormously. So you have tropical rainforests in the north and lots of rain along some of the coasts. And then you, of course, have the outback in the middle of Australia with very, very dry deserts. And so the second factor in our model was to say, well, there's going to be a lot of variation in terms of how many people can live in a certain area. The density of the population will vary based on the rainfall. And then the third factor was that there's going to be a maximum size that a population can maintain. So when a population gets past that size, it's going to divide. And when it divides, it's going to divide up into two separate populations, and they're going to speak different languages. And that was it. That was what was in this simulation model.
That third assumption, that human populations have a maximum size and that when they split, they'll speak a different language, why assume that?
So there's been a lot of work over the years done on population size and what size of population that human groups can support. And so there's a lot of theories that larger populations come with certain benefits. For example, you can have more genetic diversity, more choices for potential mates, things like that. You can have cooperation and get more resources. But they also come at a certain cost in terms of an important factor for language diversity, which is social cohesion. So can you hold your group together? Do people know each other? And do you have a cohesive social unit? And so there's a lot of hypotheses and ideas out there mentioning that when groups pass a certain point, the amount of social cohesion goes down, and the chances that the group divides become a lot higher. And when you look at data of hunting and gathering groups around the world, it appears that roughly around 500, and the number varies, but roughly around 500 seems to be a maximum size for these different groups of people. So that idea was based on a bunch of theory around social cohesion and the maximum size of groups practicing certain kinds of subsistence.
So does it follow from that it's possible the development of different languages may be an intentional act of one group to separate from another?
That's a possibility as well, absolutely. And so, you know, really what we think is that one of the keys of language is that it's a marker of group boundaries. And so the question is, what defines those breaks in those boundaries? What defines those boundaries? We think a lot of that has to do with breaks in the social cohesion of groups. And there's a lot of different things that could lead to those breaks. So you could have a larger population, and the size just gets too big, and it can't support the social cohesion it needs, and so the group divides. It could also be that there's political factors involved as well. So as we develop nation states and larger forms of political complexity, that holds larger groups of people together, too. And then movement is also important. So how far do people move, and how much area do they need to support themselves? And so all of these things affect social cohesion. And then there's the additional factor of, well, people can just decide, hey, we're not going to talk like this other group of people, right? So there's human agency certainly is a factor involved in all this.
We need to take a quick break here. Lots more to talk about. When we come back, what did researchers find when they tested out their theories based on data from Australia? Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR, become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Across the globe, people today speak about 7,000 different languages. How did we get so many languages, and why? We're speaking with Dr. Michael Gavin, Associate Professor of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. He and a group of researchers are tackling these questions. Dr. Gavin, before the break, we were talking about a model you helped develop based on theories about language diversity. What happened when you ran a simulation based on data from Australia?
Yeah, so that was pretty extraordinary because we had this really simple model, as we were mentioning, and we thought that the model wouldn't do a fantastic job of predicting this. We thought there's just not enough factors in the model, and you know the history and the complexity in Australia is truly incredible, and so you know how could this simple model do a good job of predicting language diversity? But it turned out that you know there are, based on the maps that we have of language diversity in Australia, 406 observed languages, and our model on average was producing about 407, so essentially exactly the right number of languages. And it also did a really good job of saying, well, there should be more languages in certain areas, like on the northern coast of Australia, and far fewer languages in the middle of Australia. So surprisingly, with a very few number of factors in the model, we did a pretty good job of understanding both the number of total languages that are there, as well as their spatial distribution, or where do we find more and where do we find less.
Okay, so aside from patting yourselves on the back, what specifically can you conclude then from how well your model worked?
The one thing that we were trying to do was to say, well, can we use this method? You know, this method had been used to understand the distribution of different species. So it was originally developed to study bird diversity in South America. And so we figured that this method would really allow us to begin to understand, well, what are the processes that are actually creating this kind of diversity? And so you know, we were happy to say, well, this seems to be one route forward to begin to understand some of these things, and that it performs a lot better than some previous methods that were used. So that was a nice methodological advance for us. But also what's surprising is that it would seem, at least in the continental Australia, that these few factors, particularly that rainfall is determining the density of human populations and that there's a maximum size for these populations, has a big, you know, both are big factors in shaping what this diversity looks like. But, you know, it's important also to note that although we now understand probably the major drivers of the total number of languages, you know, there's still some of the story left untold, even for Australia. So, you know, we can understand, you know, a bit more than half of the variation in how many languages are spoken in one place versus another. But, you know, there's another 40% or so of that story still to figure out. And, of course, we still have the whole rest of the world to explore.
One of the unique factors at play in Australia, I would think, is that it was a British colony for more than 100 years, beginning in the late 18th century. What impact has that had on language diversity?
That wasn't a factor that we were looking at specifically in this study. So we were really trying to understand the processes that were shaping pre-colonial patterns of language diversity. But, you know, unfortunately, the pattern for languages in Australia since the British arrival has been one of mass extinction. So there's been, you know, huge loss of diversity, and that's been a pattern globally as well in many different places.
If I heard you correctly, you've left me with the impression that the same techniques that ecologists use to study species diversity may apply to languages, that languages may follow the same patterns of diversity that species do.
Well, yeah, what's interesting about this is that broadly, on a global scale, the geographic patterns are similar. So we see far more species towards the equator.
Yeah.
We see far more languages towards the equator. And so those broad patterns are the same. And we're able to use similar methods, this simulation method of creating a computer model to sort of create a map of language diversity with certain rules in it to begin to understand both the species patterns and the language patterns. But we think in the end that the actual processes that are involved are probably quite different between these two, between different species and within human groups from one place to another.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Michael Gavin, Associate Professor of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources at Colorado State University, about why we speak so many languages. We hear about languages going extinct. How quickly are we losing languages?
That is a big question, and linguists have been working on this and producing different estimates for a while, but it seems like most will agree that roughly 50% will be lost in the next century.
Wow. Is this because speakers are growing old and dying?
It remains a question in many places, but it would appear that, you know, if I had to boil down, you know, one word that has a lot to do with this, it's probably power. And so a lot of this revolves around how we are organizing our systems of society, what languages are being taught in schools, what languages children are being encouraged to speak, what languages are being used in our economic systems. And so, you know, unfortunately, certain languages and certain groups of people aren't in control of what those systems look like, and in turn, their languages are not being spoken and not being taught to their children.
Is it possible that there used to be far more language diversity outside the tropics, but that those languages have died out?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure that those areas may have reached the level that the tropics have now. But for example, Europe, you know, a lot of theory would say that there was probably a great deal more languages in Europe before the spread of agricultural groups across Europe. And so a lot of the theory would say that agriculture allows us to live at much higher population densities and have much larger groups of people, and in turn it leads to less language diversity. And so there's a lot of theories around as agricultural groups spread, as the empires began to spread, that led to a lot of loss of language diversity in some of those places.
Can you take that one step further and speak about urbanism? I mean, I'm thinking of that first assumption of, in developing your model, that populations will move to fill available spaces. And then I think of how urbanized at least some continents have become now. It doesn't seem like people are moving to fill available spaces. It seems like people are clustering together.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, as we move into our next steps for our modeling, for example, right now we're working on a few different regions, including North America, and we're going to have to begin to tackle, well, what happens when groups of people who are already established in a place have contact with each other, and what does that lead to in terms of language diversity? But urbanization is clearly having a huge influence now, and we see, you know, some urban centers like New York and London where there are hundreds of languages spoken in those locations.
Stepping back, big picture, why do you think language diversity is important to study? What can we learn from figuring out why we speak so many languages?
I think there's two areas of this that really are interesting to me. One is, I mean, it's a fundamental fact of being human that we all, you know, we speak languages, and that we speak, there's so many different many languages spoken. To me, is a fascinating question of human history. I mean, how did this come to be? And in order to understand it, we really have to understand a lot of the intricacies of human history. So it's really interesting in that respect. The other thing I think that's really important to note, and this links to a lot of my work on environmental conservation, is that, you know, many of these languages provide us with a window into the way that different people see the world. And many of these languages and these cultures hold unique knowledge systems, which can be really important for the future of humanity. And so when we start to look at the fact that 50% of these languages may be lost in the next 100 years, we need to question, well, how much knowledge is also being lost as those languages disappear?
What is next for your research?
So next up is now taking these questions to other locations. So we've began to study this in Australia, and there's still bits of the puzzle left in Australia to figure out. But now we'd like to understand the broad patterns of language diversity in places like North America, and ultimately what you might consider the holy grail of language diversity, which is what happened on the island of New Guinea. Why are there nearly 900 languages spoken on that one island? So we have lots of big questions left to look at, and we're hoping that these modeling approaches we've developed will begin to help us answer those questions.
I wish you luck. It's really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Michael Gavin is an associate professor of Human Dimensions of Natural Resources at Colorado State University. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we'll link to Michael Gavin's article titled, Why Do Human Beings Speak So Many Languages? This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kass. Glad you've been listening. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Kast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.